What's actually the benefits when we are fasting?
Well, there's two types of fasting. One is the intermittent fasting, and that's just basically where you limit your feeding window every day.
Dr. Alan Goldhammer, leader in the field of plant-based nutrition.
He's the founder of True North Health Center in Santa Rosa, California.
The author of the book called The Pleasure Trap.
And he's a pioneer in the plant-based nutrition space.
We eat food that has chemicals added to it that stimulate dopamine production in our brains, salt, oil, and sugar. The consequence of this pleasure trap are that people eat too much and they get fat. The big mistakes people make when they fast on their own is they're too active during fasting.
What is like the right amount of fasting?
So that's an extremely good question. Unfortunately,
right, Dr. Alan Goldhammer, thanks so much for joining the show.
It's my pleasure.
So I wanted to just kind of set the premise for people listening. Some people might be familiar with fasting. Some people may, you know, have just completed a fast. Maybe they've never heard of fasting before. You are the founder of True North Health, which is the largest facility specializing in medically supervised water-only fasting. Were you guys also the first fasting center as well?
No, we certainly weren't the first. There's been people doing medically supervised fasting for a long time, but I think we're definitely the largest, and we're one of the few places that does long-term water-only fasting. So fasting ranging from 5 to 40 days on water-only that is medically supervised. And we're also one of the few places that's doing clinical trials and publishing research in the peer-reviewed literature looking at the effect of fasting on health and disease.
Right. So it's clear you're a very established expert with tons of data points from different folks around fasting. And I want people...
We've been doing this for 40 years. So since 1984, we've had 25,000 patients undergo fasting at True North Health. So we definitely have some experience in not feeding people.
Yeah, that's good for people to know, just to get that credibility of, you know, right in the front door. For people that may not understand what the benefits of fasting all of these things. I kind of wanted to set the table around there's a quote by Michelangelo, and he's a sculptor, obviously, for people that haven't heard of him. And he says, "The sculpture is already complete within the marble block before I start my work. It is already there. I just have to chisel away the superfluous material." And to me, what that means is this idea of that most people in society, when it comes to health, when it comes to maybe even their own identity, maybe it's the friends that they have or things that they want, it's all about addition. It's all about adding things to your arsenal, adding things to your personality. Maybe I want to be funnier, or maybe I want to be more charming, or maybe I want to have this kind of friend, or these many followers, or take this supplement. It's all about adding things to your arsenal. But this quote is all about the idea that we are already who we are, and we just have to remove and sculpt the excess out from ourselves, and we can find a sculptor like David Angelo. And this, to me, is a perfect example of what you guys do with promoting the art, the science of fasting, and this idea that you don't have to always focus on the right supplement. People are talking about taking, you know, the supplement, this longevity drug that everybody is looking at. And sometimes, like, the simplest way to be healthier is to not eat. What a concept.
Yeah, the fact is that people in our society, in industrialized societies, are sick mostly as a consequence of dietary excess, not deficiency. So taking pills, potions, and powders is going to have a limited effect when it comes to actually dealing with the cause of the problem, which is dietary excess. It's actually not that complicated to figure it out. People eat too much, and we know why they eat too much now, too, because of the pleasure trap, the fact that this dopamine, the neurochemical in the brain that's associated with pleasure, is stimulated by hyper-concentrated foods. So we eat food that has chemicals added to it that stimulate dopamine production in our brains. Those chemicals are salt, oil, and sugar. So when you think about it, salt, oil, and sugar aren't actually food. They're hyper-concentrated food byproducts that are added to food that make the food taste better, which essentially means stimulating more dopamine production in our brain. The consequence of this pleasure trap are that people eat too much and they get fat. And part of that fat is a type of fat called visceral fat. And visceral fat is the fat that accumulates around your belly and in your organs and is associated with inflammatory products like IL-6 and TNF-alpha and increased acute phase proteins, et cetera. And that causes certain diseases. Those include cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, autoimmune diseases, and some forms of cancer. Those diseases of dietary excess, they actually used to be called the diseases of kings because it was only the wealthy elite kings that could consistently overeat and become obese. But anyway, now these diseases of dietary excess make up to as much as 80% of the things that cause people to die prematurely. They're all associated with this syndrome called metabolic syndrome. And the consequence of this consistent overeating, this increased fat, particularly visceral fat, is why people are suffering the way that they are today and dying prematurely and becoming disabled or debilitated 20 years before they pass away. So they don't live a good life and then have a good death where they go to bed and don't wake up. They spend the last 20 years of their life unable to talk or move, lying in some nursing home bed waiting for people to come and change their diaper because they've had a stroke or a heart attack or they've developed premature cancer. And as a consequence, we spend massive amounts of money and effort treating people very unsuccessfully for diseases of dietary excess. And meanwhile, even those people that are trying to get health are often mistakenly thinking they have a deficiency. They need more vitamins, they need more protein, they need more whatever, instead of recognizing what actually is quite apparent, that they suffer from too much.
Yeah, yeah, it's a great point. And I want to contrast what our ancestors, from an evolutionary perspective, how our ancestors used to live their lifestyle, used the diets that they have. We've had David Perlmutter on, Dr. David Perlmutter, and he has this pie chart where he says that our ancestors' diet, it was about 75% fat and 25% protein and carbs, 20% protein, 5% carbs. And when you compare that to the modern diet, it's around 60, maybe even 70% of that is carbs and only 20% of that is fat and the other 20% is protein. So it's almost, we shifted this entire pie chart from fat to carbs. And I want to lean in this idea when you talked about, the SOS and how our diet is really not the way our ancestors used to eat, which means our brains are not really used to, we're not really trained. This 2 million brain that we have, it's not really trained to have all of this dopamine that comes from the foods that we eat. So we're almost tricked in some ways by the foods that we eat to continue wanting more of it, right?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure in terms of the data on the vast majority of calories coming from fat. First of all, I'd really want to take a look at that from an ancestral standpoint. But in any case, regardless of what our ancestors ate, the most important thing we want to ask ourselves is what type of diet today not only leads to living our full lifespan, but living the full lifespan, full healthy lifespan, living fully functional and not becoming debilitated. And, a diet based on animal products today, which is what traditional people are eating, where, 30, 40% of calories are coming from animal-based products. In fact, 93% of calories today come from either animal products or highly processed refined carbohydrates, so sugar, refined flour products. These highly processed foods, we know what that results in. You can look around and see what happens when people eat diets of highly processed refined carbohydrates and animal-based foods. When we shift that, like we have at the True North Health Center, to a whole plant food diet where people are able to avoid the sugar, oil, and salt, avoid the overeating, lose the weight. And then we track those patients and we've got 30 and 35 year follow-ups now on those patients. And what's fascinating is not only are they able to recover from diseases, our research has clearly shown. For example, high blood pressure, we've got to study 174 consecutive patients, 174 people achieve normal blood pressure without medication. We've got data now done in conjunction with the Mayo Clinic with 1 year follow-up data, showing not only can people get well, but they can stay well if they're able to eat a whole plant foods diet. And so, and now I've got 30, 35 year follow-up data on patients where not only are they maintaining their health into advanced age, but they're outliving everybody they know, and in some cases, including their kids, who are, you know, not following a healthier diet and lifestyle pattern. So I think there's for me anyway, compelling evidence that eating a whole plant food diet that avoids the excesses of salt, sugar, and oil, maintaining a lean and mean physique and getting regular exercise and sleep is what you do to avoid debility in the later years of life. The diet that people are eating, I believe, is a large percentage of the problem for the problems that people are experiencing. And we've been able to prove over the last 40 years that you can reverse that and you can sustain that.
Yeah. I mean, the things that you mentioned, they're very compelling evidence, and it's backed by people that actually have gone through the protocols that you guys have recommended. What's happening there exactly? I mean, for people that may have never fasted, don't really understand the benefits beyond the idea of like, okay, if you don't eat, logically it makes sense that if you don't eat for a, you know, 14 hours to 3 days, that it is just better for your body because you don't eat the sugar, you don't eat the salt, you don't eat the bad fat that we normally eat in our diets. But beyond that, like from a scientific perspective, what's actually the benefits of the things that are happening in our bodies when we are fasting?
Well, there's two types of fasting. We should really differentiate that. One is the intermittent fasting that Valter Longo and others have done some fabulous research looking at. And that's just basically where you limit your feeding window every day. And what we've done at True North for the last 40 years, actually, is limited the feeding windows in most patients to 8 hours a day. So they feed during an 8-hour window, they fast during a 16-hour window, and they do that every day, you know, indefinitely. That 8-hour window is enough to provide enough time to consume enough calories of low density, high nutrition food in order to get people's needs met. And that what that means is you're not eating 3 to 4 hours before you go to bed at night. And so instead of eating right until you go to sleep and then having to store the foods you eat at night that you can't burn as fat and having sleep disruption and all the downstream consequences and also creating a window for the opportunity to overeat, you limit your feeding window, your sleep quality improves. And then there's a period between your last meal and your next meal the next day of somewhere between 12 and 16 hours. And even that little bit of fasting is thought to induce metabolic changes that are thought to be cumulatively beneficial. Now, that's one type of fasting. Everybody can do that. They can do it on their own. They don't need anybody to, you know, hold their hand through it. when you go beyond 16 hours of fasting, though, now you start getting into where you're depleting glycogen stores. And the potential complications change, particularly for people on medications or people that have health problems. So when we want to go beyond 16 hours into what we do, which is long-term medically supervised water-only fasting, ranging up to 40 days on water only, that requires history, exam, lab, and monitoring in order to avoid complications from the wrong people fasting or people fasting inappropriately. Mm-hmm. The big mistakes people make when they fast on their own is they're too active during fasting, or they have problems with refeeding. They're too rapid at recovery feeding.
Active meaning like they work refeeding. Out, or they go to the gym and they do yoga, right. All these things.
Right, or they're driving or going to work. When you do water fasting beyond 16 hours, rest is an important part of it. And the reason is, after about 24 to 48 hours, depending on the person, your glycogen reserves are completely depleted. The only way you can get glucose is through gluconeogenesis, which is the breakdown of lean tissue, breakdown of protein. So what happens is if you're very active, your need for glucose goes up because your brain, which is your biggest burner of glucose, is active, and your muscles, which are another source of need for glucose, are active. The only place that the brain can get the glucose it needs if you're going to be very active is from the breakdown of lean tissue, because you don't have any more glycogen stores anymore. Except when you get into the fasting mode. In the fasting mode, the brain shifts from burning glucose to burning beta-hydroxybutyric acid, essentially ketones. So that fuel shift changes so that the farther you get into fasting, the more effective that fuel shift is. By the end of the second week of fasting, the majority of calories are coming from the brain is burning is coming from fat. Well, that's great unless you're very active. then you need some minimal extra glucose need, not just by the brain, but by the muscles. And that would come from lean tissue breakdown. So if your goal is to minimize muscle loss and maximize fast loss, that requires rest. If you're more active, you'll lose more weight, but it won't be more fat. It'll be lean tissue.
Yeah.
Now, we've proven this. We had a DEXA scanner at the True North Health Center for 2 years. We did a study. It's been published in the peer-reviewed journal. Your viewers can go to fasting.org and get all the things I'm talking about. All the studies are freely available. And what we showed is exactly that, that, for example, say a healthy male fasted for 15 days would lose 20% of their total body fat, but 55% of their visceral fat. So the visceral fat to the lean tissue loss is adipose tissue loss is 3-1. So it's like the body selectively is going to the things it doesn't want to be there first. That's why, for example, let's say you go on a fast and lose 10% of your body weight, but you don't lose 10% of your tumor rate. You might lose 50% or 100% of the tumor. So how could you lose 100% of a tumor when you only lost 10% of the body? The body doesn't mobilize tissues linearly. It selectively goes in. If you take an animal and fast it to death, you'll find its nervous system is not impacted. Mm. In other words, the body will preserve some tissues, it sacrifices other tissues, mobilizes the tissues that shouldn't be there preferentially to those that should often, and that's where visceral fat is preferentially mobilized to adipose tissue.
Yeah.
Lean tissue is preserved, but in order to maximize lean tissue preservation, you rest. That same individual that lost 55% of their body weight lost 4% of their lean tissue. And that what's interesting, though, is that 6-week follow-up in this study, the amount of lean tissue as a proportion of body was actually higher than at baseline. So not only had they recovered the 4% of lean tissue they lost during the fast, during the 6-week subsequent refeeding, but even more. The total fat loss continued. So even as people are regaining weight and they're putting weight on after the fast, rehydrating, putting on protein, fiber, glycogen, their fat loss is continuing. So the scale is going up, but the fast loss is going down, visceral fat proportionally. So the point is that you transform your body during this process. You might lose 20 pounds and gain 10 pounds back, but the 10 pounds you gained back was entirely lean tissue, not fat. Now, that's assuming, obviously, people are eating a whole plant food diet. They're not going back to greasy, fatty, slimy processed foods.
Yeah. So I want to take a step back a little bit. So we talked about kind of these benefits, but, you know, go back to intermittent fasting for a little bit there, Ashley. So you talked about 16 hours of fasting, 8 hours eating window. Why not 14? Why not 13, 12 hours? Like, why is 16 just a number that was studied the most and it's been published, or is there some science back?
Well, actually, most of the research is 12 hours of fasting and 12 hours of feeding. And that's the same model we use for people trying to gain weight. So if a person's trying to gain weight, like if you have children or you have athletes, 8 hours may not be enough feeding time to get enough calories in of this low density food that we advocate. That is a whole plant food diet in order to be able to sustain optimum weight, energy, and function. But if for people trying to maintain weight or lose weight, we find that an 8-hour feeding window is sufficient to be able to provide room to eat enough of the low density foods. You think about the feeding bag, the stomach. If you're filling it up with whole plant foods, these all have relatively low caloric density. So they're somewhere between 1 and 500 calories a pound, most of them. So when you think about the volume of the human stomach, you can get 500, 600, 700 calories of, you know, salads and steamed vegetables, potatoes, rice, beans into that chamber. So you're going to fill it up 3 times a day in order to get the average calories that most people need. An athlete might need to fill up the feeding bag 4 times a day. Mm. Somebody trying to lose weight, maybe they only have to fill it up twice a day. Or maybe they have a lower metabolic rate, or they're less active, they're older, whatever. So the point is, you got to assign the program to the person, not try to match the person to the program. So for most people that are trying to maintain or lose weight, we find an 8-hour feeding window to be good. Most of the literature on fasting restriction recommends 12-hour feeding window, 12-hour fasting window. That's what most of the data says. So there's not as much, because it's harder to do an 8-hour feeding window. Mm. The truth is, people have their way. They just like to eat all the time. Oh, that's great. You get all that dopamine stimulation secondary time you put stuff in your mouth. And the problem is, when you do that, particularly with processed foods, you get fat. And 72% of people are now overweight or obese, and it's increasing by the day.
Yeah.
The only way you get 2/3 of the population or 3/4 of the population to engage in health compromising behavior is to fundamentally fool the normal satiety mechanism to prevent that from happening. Think about animals. There's no obese animals living on natural diets. Even whales are only 9% body fat. They look, you think of them as fat. They're not fat at all. They're lean. They're just, they wear the fat on the outside of their body. So the way you get animals fat is just give them access to highly processed foods. Put sugar, oil, and salt in their foods. The rats will gain 49% of their body weight in 60 days. The birds will get so fat they can't fly. This isn't psychology. This isn't because mommy rat didn't love them enough or daddy bird loved them too much or they had stress of going to work. This is biology. This is fooling the satiety mechanism of the brain with chemicals added to the feed. And we're doing exactly the same thing to humans.
Yeah.
And we know what we're doing. That's food manufacturers have laboratories they set up specifically to be able to give you what you want, not what you need.
Yeah, and that eating window of restricted 8 hours does allow us to get less calories, a whole, you know, eating well, that's all part of the plan. I'm listening to this as maybe someone that's not as familiar with the benefits of fasting. Let's say within that 8 hour eating window, you eat, I don't know, 1,000 to 2,000 calories. What's the difference between that versus someone not fasting, but within a 24-hour eating window, they have the same amount of calories? What's happening to our bodies from that first eating window of 8 hours? Same calories, same foods versus the 24-hour window where they
Well, that's a really good question. I have to say, though, I'm not an expert on intermittent fasting. What I'm most familiar with is the biology and physiology associated with long-term water-only fasting. So I can talk about what happens when you haven't eaten for 5 days to 40 days. More authoritatively than I can tell you what the literature is saying about this intermittent fasting. What I would say is that those questions are really best asked of Walter Longo, who's advocating intermittent fasting short term. And they talk, there's a paper in the Journal of Metabolism in 2015 that he wrote that talks about all of the kind of biological changes that are associated with intermittent fasting. Now, what's interesting is they're all the same kind of things you see with long-term fasting, the same kinds of changes. They're just not as powerful because obviously there's a huge biological difference between a 5 day or a 40 day fast and a 16 hour fast.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
A fasting mimicking diet. So it mimics the changes we see in long-term fasting, but how much, how effectively, how many days you have to fast, you know, I don't know that that's well established. Certainly, it's not something I'm familiar enough with to start trying to pretend like I know exactly what the answer to that excellent question is.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. And your expertise and your the experience that you got, what you guys do at True North is extended fasting, which I guess can be counted as minimum 3 days or more. Is that what you would count that?
The truth is it's all a kind of a curve because by 16 hours, you're starting to see some changes. By 24, there's more. At 3 days, you're in ketosis. You've depleted glycogen stores. You know, from a practical standpoint, we're talking usually 5 to 40 days to see the larger clinical impacts. And it's not linear. Like 1 day of fasting between day 20 and day 21 is very different than 1 day of fasting between day 2 and day 3 in terms of its biological effect. You may have a patient fasting for 19 days and not see much happen clinically. And then from day 19 to 23, you see the tumor reduced, the blood pressure normalized, the blood sugars. So you reach these thresholds depending on the person. Sometimes it'll take multiple fasts to resolve a problem. It might be the third fast that you get a resolution of the clinical concern that you're looking at. And it's hard to know in advance because we don't have good non-invasive biological markers yet. The only people in the world really doing serious long-term water-only fasting and tracking it right now is the True North Health Center. There's a couple places in China that are starting to look into it. There's the Buchenauer Clinic does modified fasting in Germany, and they publish excellent work. But the long-term water fasting that we're doing at True North is really rather novel, and that's why we've been working with Luigi Fontana from Washington University. We just had a paper that came out in Lancet Previews with the Mayo Clinic. Dr. Scharf, a paper that's just come out with long-term fasting and cardiometabolic changes and 12-month follow-up data showing what happens to people that maintain these diets. We've got numerous case reports, including in the British Medical Journal, about the reversal of follicular lymphoma. I've got one case now with a 10-year follow-up of cancer-free, and we've got a cohort of lymphoma patients that's in review for publication right now. So there's no question a lot of these conditions will respond to long-term fasting. And what's exciting is we're able to sustain those results if people are willing to do dangerous and radical things. That is, eat well, exercise, and go to bed on time.
Radical. Let's not get too crazy now.
Well, radical comes from the word radicus, which means root or cause. And I think that's exactly what we're doing, is we're dealing with the root or cause, the dietary excess, particularly excess animal fats and proteins and sugars and refined carbohydrates that lead people down this road of compromised health.
So walk me through, like, why should someone do an extended fasting versus intermittent fasting? I mean, I've done a three-day fast a few times already. You definitely see a big difference in terms of the impacts in your body, and it's almost like a psychological challenge, the idea that you can go 3 days without eating. Like, it almost seems crazy, but it's the superpower once you do it, knowing that you can do it again. There's a self-confidence that builds over time. But
so it's true. Yeah. You know, when people have fasted for 3 weeks or for 40 days, the idea of having to skip a meal doesn't seem quite so overwhelming to them. You know, if they, you know, get into a situation where there's not healthy food, they don't feel like, oh, they're going to die, you know, if they don't eat whatever.
It's a perception.
But it's more than that. Some of it's biological. For example, when you do fasting, even short-term fasting like you're talking about, it has a profound effect on blood insulin level and blood glucose levels. For example, when people eat sugar, you know, it drives insulin up and then it brings your sugar down and your brain thinks you're starving. That's what a lot of this binging and craving comes about. It's just this bouncing of blood glucose and blood insulin levels as a consequence of the chemical effect of refined carbohydrates. As soon as you stop doing that, all of a sudden blood sugar levels start stabilizing. People don't get such vacillations in their insulin production as a consequence. They, you know, the idea of eating a meal an hour later or something isn't a big problem. Your brain isn't telling you that you're dying because your blood sugar levels now are bottoming them out because your insulin levels are excessive from overstimulation from the toxic food that you've shoved in your feeding hole. So fasting tends to normalize glucose levels, but also fasting has a profound detoxification effect. A lot of these intermediary products of metabolism, both exogenous like PCB dioxin, pesticide residues, and endogenous, things that aren't really toxins, but when there's too much of them in the wrong place, like, for example, cholesterol levels or something, you can plug up your blood vessels with fat and have real serious problems. Those processes of detoxification rapidly accentuate during fasting. In fact, they do so efficiently that some people warn people, oh, don't ever fast because your body will detoxify and all those toxins will be in your system and your body will be overloaded and it's a real serious problem. Unless, of course, you take their proprietary products, then apparently it's okay. But the point is, there is this rapid detoxification and the body is well equipped to mobilize and eliminate these metabolic products, and it does so very rapidly. And so detoxification is a part of fasting. Dealing with blood sugar levels and insulin resistance is a profound benefit of fasting. About 80% of our type 2 diabetics will achieve normal blood sugar without medication. And so now, again, you have to do the diet and the exercise in order to maintain it. What's interesting, actually, is if you look at the exercise literature and you notice all the benefits from exercise and all the metabolic changes they've identified, for example, BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, that's a chemical that protects the brain from oxidative damage, which is thought to be the cause of Alzheimer's and dementia and stuff. They noticed when they took rats that were genetically bred rats, so identical rats, two different sets, one and fed exactly the same. One set of rats, another set of rats, the only difference, one set of rats was given a wheel or could exercise in the cage. And they did. The rats that have the wheel would exercise. The rats that had the wheels and that exercised didn't develop Alzheimer's disease. And they said, why? What was it about exercise that prevents these rats from getting Alzheimer's disease? And they found one difference was dramatically higher BDNF levels in the rats that exercised. And they found that the BDNF was a chemical that prevented oxidative damage in the brain, and it was thought to protect the brain from developing the changes that are associated with dementia. Well, guess what also increases BDNF levels besides exercise? Fasting.
Fasting.
If you take rats and you systematically fast them, you can double their lifespan. They live twice as long, everything else being equal. And so with either systematic underfeeding or with fasting. And you might start thinking, okay, we can look at lots of different chemicals. It's the same thing. The things that improve with exercise also improve with fasting. And then you might, it's an interesting non-intuitive question because you say, well, wait a second. Fasting, you rest. exercise, you're all vigorous. Why would they both induce the same chemical changes? Well, my theory is that both exercise and fasting have one very important thing in common, is they both undo the consequences of dietary excess. And it's dietary excess that's causing these problems to begin with. So whether you're exercising or you're fasting, or preferably doing both, but not at the same time, fasting appropriately, whether it's intermittent fasting or long-term fasting, incorporating a diet and exercise, you can actually reverse the consequence of dietary excess, get rid of the fat, get rid of the visceral fat, get rid of the inflammation that's associated with that, and the body heals itself. And it will delay that premature aging that comes from oxidative damage from dietary excess.
Yeah. There is a hormesis sense of that stressing of your body when you're exercising. And it is similar when you're fasting, right? There, your body is under stress. It's a good kind of stress, because it's the kind of stress that's something that you can overcome with autophagy and so forth.
Right. And just like exercise, you can do too much, or you can do it wrong and end up being hurt. With fasting, you can do too much, or you can do it wrong and you can end up hurt. So when you exercise, a lot of people think, well, you know, there's a way to do it. You warm up, you exercise appropriately. You don't overdo, right? You try to stay within your REMs. You do it progressively. You do it within your capacities. You're monitoring yourself sometimes in order to be able to not. The same thing holds true for fasting. You do it properly. You follow appropriate protocols. And if you're successful at doing that, you win. You have a good outcome. But everybody knows the examples of people in the gym working out inappropriately and doing damage. In my business, I get to see, unfortunately, people that use fasting inappropriately and end up damaged.
Yeah, I was just in Korea, spending about 2 months there, and their healthcare system is very top notch, where people get public access to a yearly checkup of their entire bodies. And what they're saying is, because they are catching cancers so early, one of the leading causes of death and diseases is now brain health. And that's probably spread across around the world as well. I'm sure the US as well. And it seems like a lot of people in my life are starting to talk a little bit more about that. So you said BDNF is kind of the main, a very big protector of this, and fasting is certainly helpful for that. How do you optimize that? Like, what is, from your studies, what is like the right amount of fasting? If someone is solely trying to optimize their BDNF because they want to minimize the brain disease, what is the right amount?
So that's an extremely good question. Unfortunately, there's a limited amount of research. Now, on intermittent fasting, the rich literature says that people should fast every day from between 12 and 16 hours. So, and there's a little bit of debate in the literature about what the optimum amount of feeding and fasting time is, and I don't pretend to be an expert on that. But somewhere in that 12 to 16 hours. Now, we have practiced a 16-hour model at True North Health. And except for people that are trying to gain weight, for people trying to build up, we use a 12-hour window. For people that are trying to stabilize or lose, we use a 16-hour window. The research looking at, for example, quantitative BDNF and stuff hasn't been done yet. So, that's something we are interested in doing and we will be doing. And the same is true for long-term fasting. For sick people, it's not that complicated. We fast until they're well, if they have the reserves to do it. For example, if you come in with blood pressure and your blood pressure is 220 over 110 and you're capped out on 5 medications, we know that's probably going to take a longer fast. And we want to fast you until your blood pressure is in a healthy range, or at least low enough that we can eliminate the need for medication, build you back up, and then do it again until we see blood pressures that we expect to see. And interestingly enough, that's not 120 over 80. It's closer to 90 over 60. When you take healthy people, their blood pressures are significantly lower than average non-pathological patients. But that's a whole other issue.
Sure.
So with sick people, you fast until you get them well, or until you've reached their reserves. Now, we're monitoring people at True North Health twice a day. We're doing blood. We're doing urine. So we're looking at electrolyte levels. We're looking at their physical exam twice a day. So we have a lot of little protocols and parameters we follow to make sure that we don't go too long. We don't go from fasting into starvation. And we know that we do that safely because we've published a fasting safety study and we've done it for 40 years. And so far, despite the fact we treat lots of old and sick people, everybody that's walked in has walked out. So we've got a really fabulous safety record and a published fasting safety study showing that fasting can be done safely and effectively when it's done according to the protocol. In fact, Walter Longo wrote a book on fasting, and he said, don't do long-term fasting because it can be dangerous. unless you do it at the True North Health Center, because he knows the protocol that we follow. Mm. And so, you know, since I evaluate other researchers' intelligence based on how much they agree with me, I consider him a genius.
So for people that are not, you know, maybe they don't have access to True North Health and right. they are relatively healthy, but, you know, they want to lose weight or they want to, you know, reduce brain disease in the future. Would you say just intermittent fasting is the way to go, you think, for
most? I would say everybody should fast 16 hours a day. Everybody should adopt a whole plant food SOS-free diet. So SOS is the international symbol of danger, but it also stands for the chemicals added to food that make people fat, sick, and miserable, and that's salt, oil, and sugar. That everybody should, to their capacities, get into a moderate, regular exercise program. That everybody should remember that sleep is one of our most important activities, and that sleep deprivation is immunosuppressive, makes it difficult to lose weight because of the effect on metabolic rate, et cetera. So diet, sleep, and exercise are the key. Fasting every day for 16 hours, and if it's appropriate, a periodic period of longer fasting. For healthy people, we often recommend a week, a year of fasting. Remember, if you're going to fast, though, talk to your doctor about history, exam, lab. Make sure you're a good candidate. When you fast, you rest. And when you refeed according to protocol. That is, it takes half the length of the fast to get back to caloric density. You don't go from fasting to eating highly processed foods, or you can get post-fasting edema, refeeding syndrome. You can get it, you make yourself sick. So if you're going to fast, do it right. We think that healthy people a week, a year may be enough because you use it diagnostically. If you fast for a week and you're okay, no symptoms, move on to that healthy eating and do that every, you know, for the next 51 weeks. If you have health problems, though, we would recommend long-term fasting depending on the condition, but that does require medical history, exam, lab, and monitoring. If you can't come to a place like True North or one of the places that does that, we do have doctors, for example, that can work with your local doctor so that you could fast remotely. But you still have to get your local doctor to provide lab monitoring. You still have to rest. You can't be driving around and putting yourself and others at risk. You still have to refeed very carefully. And those are the two things that people have trouble doing, is getting the rest they need at home or recovering properly. So that's where I'm hesitant on the long-term fasting. It's not that the fasting itself is the problem, but it does need to be done right so that people don't make a mess of it. And for people on medications, don't fast on medications, but don't just discontinue your medications until you've talked to a doctor that's not an idiot that can help you figure out a strategy for making it work.
We talked off air about this idea of like someone thinking that they're healthy, doing a long-term fast, and then realizing all of these health problems that happen when they're 2 or 3 days into the fast. Is that just that they don't react well to fasting in general, but they're actually perfectly healthy individuals? And it's just that long-term fastings are maladaptive to the way their body structure works? Or is it the fact that they're actually unhealthy?
No, there are people that have, like, for example, MCAD, medium chain acetylcoenzyme A dehydrogenase deficiency. They don't break down fatty acids. If they try to fast, they're going to start vomiting and die. So, you know, that wouldn't be a good thing. Mm. You have people that have other genetic defect, porphyria. So, you know, they don't break down their blood components properly. So they would be a relative contraindication to fasting. People have, they don't know it, but they might have gall or kidney stones that might pass during fasting because the body tries to slough off and get rid of stuff. That can be uncomfortable and raise issues. There are people that have, you know, if you're a type 1 diabetic, you know, mommy gave you cow's milk when you were a kid and now your islet cells have been destroyed and you don't make insulin, you're not going to be a good candidate for fasting because you need insulin in order to be able to adapt the fast. So there's a lot of people that are not good candidates for fasting, absolutely. But for healthy people, it's very rare. But think about this. Fasting is a biological adaptation. All the humans that couldn't fast in our ancient ancestry, they died. Mm-hmm. They all died because every time spring came late, human beings with this large bulbous neuronal net, our biggest burner of glucose, doesn't work. You will never find chimps wandering away from the tropics. Hmm. Even though their brain is 2.5 times smaller than ours, they don't fast. So if they go without food for a week, they're in trouble. And so would humans if we couldn't fast. You could go about a week instead of you. A healthy male can fast about 70 days because of the ability to go into fasting. I'm not saying you should, by the way, but the point is you have the biological capacity because all the humans that couldn't fast died because our bulbous neuronal net, our biggest burner of glucose, is so glucose demanding that all it would take is, you know, a late spring. And so now all humans do this. Every race, every culture, all across the planet, with the exception of a few people that have genetic defects, are able to fast. All we're doing is taking this ancient practice and applying it in a very unnatural situation. It's only the last couple hundred years since the Industrial Revolution that dietary excess has even been a regular issue for humans. And so this dietary excess that leads to the fat and the visceral fat that causes the diseases that you're seeing, we're just applying it to deal and undo the consequences of this recent phenomenon where people can eat too much.
Adding on to this idea of like where some people obviously are not suitable for especially long-term fast, what about the when it comes to gender differences where, you know, I've heard whether it's Dave Asprey or a few other people talk about some issues that maybe women have from like hormonal issues when it comes to probably a long-term fasting, but maybe even intermittent fasting. Have you seen similar patterns in your client base? And why is that?
Yeah, well, there's no question that women are profoundly affected by fasting. In fact, we use fasting to treat some of the most common problems that women experience. The polycystic ovarian syndrome, the fibrocystic breast disease, the dysmenorrhea, the menorrhagia, the uterine fibroids, all these problems that seem to be associated with the conversion of estradiol to estriol and that whole hormonal cascading block seems to be positively impacted by fasting, in part probably because of the impact on the gut microbiome. So, you know, when you think about the gut microbiome, you have, what, over a trillion creatures swimming around in your gut, 5 pounds of organisms that are living creatures, living in your digestive system, eating, drinking, pooing inside you. And what they poo in you largely depends on what you feed them. So if you want a lot of TMA, feed them a lot of animal food. And that's why animal eaters have different microbiome than plant eaters. So people that eat, you know, carnivorial type diets have completely different organisms, different waste products, lots of TMA, which becomes trimethylamine oxidase, which increases colon, you know, cancer and heart disease and all the other stuff. Plant eaters have 1,000 different bacteria species that and organisms that live in their gut. They have different waste products, lots of vitamin K and other fertilizer. And so, you know, we advocate a healthy diet in part because the organisms that are so important to your health, that's what determines who they are and what they give off is what you feed them. And we know that feeding, you know, plant-based foods, for example, to organisms has a completely different effect than feeding animal-based foods.
I guess my question, though, is I'm hearing that women actually have more problems from fasting rather than fasting helping those problems.
Well, I don't know about intermittent fasting, but with long-term water fasting, that's clearly not the case. I have not seen anything that works as well for dealing with ovarian cysts, polycystic ovarian syndrome, fibromyalgia, dysmenorrhea, menorrhagia. These conditions respond dramatically and often within the context of the fast. And in fact, many of the patients we have come in that have unclear infertility issues, you fast them within a cycle or two, they're having babies. So, I mean, you know, I think that fasting has a normalizing effect both on males and females. And in some ways, you know, females have a little bit more complicated biological systems. There's more things that can go wrong. And so we see about 60% of our patients are actually females.
So you see no differences in terms of, you see all of the same benefits, but you don't see any of the downsides of the differences between when a man fasts for, you know, 3 days, 5 days, 10 days versus a woman. There's no statistical differences.
Well, the one difference is that women don't complain as much. Men tend to be bigger complainers about, you know, symptoms. But women are a lot tougher. And so we have a lot less trouble with women than we do with the men.
Okay. Noted. Interesting. Yeah. So I guess the...
Like I tell a lot of guys, you know, when they're trying to get healthy, they can come or not come, but make sure they send their wife because we know who's going to do all the work anyway. So.
Yeah. Fair point. Okay, so there's no real differences that you're seeing. So maybe it is intermittent fasting that people are talking more about, which
well, I think that most of these guys wouldn't really have any experience with long-term fasting because none of them are doing long-term water-only fasting with patients. They're all doing relatively short duration fasting. And I don't know, maybe there are symptoms they see in women that, you know, one of the things I have seen with fasting is if you start fasting and you try to break it while the body is actively healing, it takes a lot longer to get well than if you just fast through the crisis. The trick is differentiating a healing crisis, which is the body's acute response to attempt to get well, from an actual problem. One of the problems with fasting is some people assume every bad thing that happens is a good thing, is a healing crisis, and it's not. Sometimes it's because people's electrolytes are out. Sometimes it's because, you know, people are having trouble adapting to the fast. Sometimes it's because they're overactive, so they're dehydrated. That may be the most common problem. Mm-hmm. Or they're getting refeeding syndrome, so they're getting problems after fasting that they're attributing to the fast, when in reality it's the feeding that they're doing after the fast that's the problem.
Yeah, it's the inconsistencies when it comes to intermittent fasting that I understand, like, your expertise is more on the long-term fast, but I do wonder if that does take into effect. So for example, you know, a lot of people, and including myself, Monday to Friday, no problem intermittent fasting. And then you have the weekend that comes, right? It is sometimes hard to continue to maintain the schedule, but just like sleeping is only effective if you continue to maintain that schedule every day. I wonder how that affects intermittent fasting if you do it consistently from Monday to Friday, but then Saturday to Sunday, you have your cheat meals, you go drinking and you don't sleep well. I wonder if that actually deters the whole effect of intermittent fasting if you can't keep that consistent.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question for the intermittent fasting experts like Walter Longo. And I'd be interested to hear what he has to say.
Yeah, I'd love to have him on.
You know, understand, mostly I deal with clinically ill patients. They have hypertension, diabetes, or cancer. So there's no cheat meals. We try to intimidate them into eating healthy every day so their body has a chance to actually get well. So it's a little different than dealing with maybe the average person that's healthy, that's just trying to apply these principles to, you know, preserve their health and maintain their health. What I would say, though, is after fasting, it has a very profound effect, for example, on taste and adaptation. A lot of the stuff that people crave or they think they like, after fasting, they find they don't, it's too salty, it's too sugary, they don't need it anymore. They neuroadapt, and so it gets it easier and easier to eat healthy all the time because it becomes less appealing. You know, there's a normalization that occurs. I would suggest that most people in our society are actually addicted to the artificial stimulation of dopamine in their brain coming from the drugs they eat and drink and the chemicals in the food that they're eating. And they don't even realize that only 12% of people in society are even considered metabolically healthy now. 88% of people are not metabolically healthy. And of the 12% that may be metabolically healthy, many of them are not well. They have other issues. Some of them are metabolically healthy because they're not overeating and they've quit drinking, but they've done it because they've been dealing with disease. When we did this study trying to look at the effect of long-term fasting on healthy people, we had trouble recruiting patients. People would come in thinking they're healthy, but when we actually test them out, they didn't meet the standard. Where we found most of our subjects were actually staff working at True North Health Center, where they work and live there and eat there all the time. Mm-hmm. And they actually tested out as metabolically healthy. But it's hard to find people in society now that are actually healthy.
Yeah, that seems to be maybe a benefit of these long-term fastings that maybe people don't really talk about. You know, I used to eat a lot of sweets, and now it's very, very rare that I would eat anything sweet.
And it's not discipline, is it? It's because you don't want it as much.
Yeah, it's just you don't crave it. And I recently had something where someone gave me a mango. Mangoes are not in season here. And I'm like, this is incredibly sweet. And I'm like, how is this not in season? And for them, this is like salty, this is bitter, this is not sweet at all. And I realized my taste buds have been more sensitive. So for people that are eating regularly salt, oil, sugar, that it almost desensitizes them to that level of their basic need of sugar, right?
We actually did a study on this taste neuroadaptation. It was published in Curious. And we actually were able to show that after fasting, the actual perception, minimum detection threshold to salt and sugar changes, and that the hedonic response to food changes, that good foods start to taste good. We've actually, if you go onto fasting.org, you can find the study that actually, we actually quantified that very response. We knew it was happening because after fasting, people would eat the chard and go, oh my God, they put salt on the chard. Mm. And it's the same chard. It's just, you can actually taste it. You know, we talk about, we became a fully covered medical benefit for one of the big labor unions in California. And so these are the crane operators that, you know, could come to the center if they had high blood pressure or diabetes, no cost. We do our thing. And we did a long-term study to show whether or not these guys the union would save money getting them healthy rather than, you know, cutting their feet off with diabetes and having heart attacks and all the rest of it. And the very first guy they sent us was a guy whose blood pressure was 220 over 120. He was capped out on 5 meds, grossly overweight, diabetic. And, you know, he shows up at the center and he's looking around and they told him, look, you go here, you get well, you go back to work. But they didn't tell him what the program was. So he didn't know he was going to have to be doing fasting. And so he was walking around. He's going, no, I'm in the wrong place. And I said, no, you're in the right place. Here's your name on the list. You know, you're here to get well. He says, no, it's not me. I'm not sick. I'm fine. And, you know, I'm like, oh, come on. You're diabetic. You're hypertensive. You got a keg around your belly. Not only are you sick, you're going to die. And he's like, well, aren't we all going to die? And I said, well, okay, wait a second. Now, you're on $880 a month worth of medications. If we get you healthy, you won't need the drugs. And he said, what do I care? I don't pay for the drugs. The union pays for the drugs. And so I'm realizing, okay, this isn't my normal patient we typically see at True North Health, but I don't want to strike out. I got this contract. So I'm talking to the guy and thinking, what do we know about diabetic hypertensive males on a lot of medications? Well, a lot of them have infants. And so I said, you know, if we get you healthy, we might be able to do something about your little problem. So he starts to stand up and he's like, well, why the hell didn't you just say so? So we start talking. He's a triple cheeseburger guy. He lives on triple cheeseburger without the lettuce, though. He said if they made a mistake and put any lettuce on there, he'd throw that away because he didn't eat rabbit food. Bottom line, we realize we have to feed him. We give him some food. He can't eat the food. He's trying to eat the food. He's like, can't swallow the food. I'm thinking he's got a tumor. In reality, he's just, it's so disgusting to him. 26 days of water fasting later, he's lost 50 pounds. He normalizes his blood pressure. He's off his meds. And now he's actually eating the food. And I sat down to him. I said, it looks like you're doing better, you know, with the food. And he goes, yeah, your damn chef's finally getting the hang of it. Because the tasteless, disgusting swill that he couldn't choke down before, you know, now it wasn't bad. And this was, you know, he wouldn't have complied for a day if we sent him home with a diet program. But after fasting, his taste, his neuroadaptation palate changed. He was able to choke down what used to be tasteless swill. And now it was not bad. You know, 6 months later, I saw him at the semi-annual doing blood pressure screening. I asked him how he was doing. He said he was doing just fine.
Yeah, that reset is really key. And I don't think people really talk about that enough. Talk to me a little bit about caffeine and fasting. So I feel like I almost cheated because when I did my 3-day fast, I drank caffeine and I also put electrolyte powder into it.
Caffeine is a highly addictive nervous system stimulant. It has absolutely no place in a health promoting program, and particularly not in fasting. So we wouldn't use caffeine any more than we would use cocaine during fasting, and for the same kind of reasons. As far as electrolyte powders and stuff, there's a disadvantage to doing that. We can talk about that. But as far as fasting, it's water only in an environment of rest. And the biological changes associated with it are most obvious when you do it that way. So there's all kinds of modified fasting out there, including ones where you're taking, in fact, most of the intermittent fasting programs can give you 600 calories, 800 calories of whether it's fat or whether it's juices or, you know, different programs. The Buchenauer clinics use broths and juices. The advantage to those modified mimicking fasts is that are safe. You can often do them without medical supervision, assuming drugs and medications are not involved. There are things that people are likely to get away with doing on their own better than would be water-only fasting that requires history, exam, lab, and monitoring. So I have no problem with the idea of using those intermittent fasting techniques successfully. It's not my area of expertise. You know, I'm doing long-term water-only fasting, so that's really what I'm
so best even for longer term, you recommend not drinking caffeine. You think that deters the effects, the benefits that you can get?
I'd recommend not drinking caffeine for anyone ever. So
that was my second question.
I also recommend using cocaine ever.
Did I hear that you quit coffee or you never drank coffee?
I've never had coffee or alcohol or drugs. But I mean, because I was fortunate, I got started as a kid. I'm 65 years old now. I got started when I was, as a teenager. So, you know, young kid before people usually get exposed to those substances.
Interesting. You never tried caffeine?
No.
Wow.
Not so far.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a common thing. I mean, it's something that I struggle with probably. It's something that I'm trying to cut down. I don't know if you've read the book by Michael Pollan where he quit coffee for 3 months and he talked about how he just slept like a teenager again, you know, at the age of 50 or however old he is. And
well, coffee has a 7-hour half-life. The coffee you drink in the morning even disrupts the quality of your sleep at night. That's one of the many problems with using caffeine. Now, I know people like it because it makes them feel good. It's this powerful stimulant. And because it's from plants, there's a little bit of nutrition, including quite a bit of antioxidants and stuff, you know, that hasn't been destroyed in the process of making it. But, you know, that's like trying to argue that red wine is healthy for you because it happens to have a little bit of resveratrol left from the grape skin. So,
yeah, yeah. Matthew Walker also talks about this idea that as we get older, we produce less melatonin, which means we're getting less deep sleep. So obviously caffeine is a major disruptor of that, and less deep sleep means probably more chances of getting...
Sorry about that.
Yeah, no worries, no worries. Anyways, we can probably skip that part. To talk a little bit about kind of helping people get on the right diet. So let's say for myself, I'm trying to quit caffeine. What are, for other people, it might be cutting sugar, salt, stuff like that. So beyond just telling them to fast and to quit, easier said than done in most cases, what are some of the protocols you put people into from a psychological perspective where they can be less tempted and create a system that allows them to make that easier instead of just relying on willpower and motivation?
Well, I mean, one of the great benefits of fasting is that it makes the withdrawal from addictive drugs much easier, whether it's caffeine, alcohol, cocaine, whatever. You know, after a couple of days of fasting, most people no longer have the physiological cravings, including nicotine. It's interesting when you take smokers and you fast them, after a few days, they're really not craving cigarettes anymore. Now, some people say, yeah, they're so miserable from fasting, they aren't thinking about the smoking, but it's not really true. Just the whole, all those detoxifying processes go through much more rapidly. And as a consequence, it makes it a lot easier to get people free of their addictions, not the least of which is to sugar, oil, and salt. You know, by definition, people take substances, when they stop them, they take substances to feel good, but then when they stop taking them, they feel really bad. As a consequence, that's one of the great benefits of fasting, is helping quit those substances.
Yeah. And then final question for people that are trying to, let's say, fast for the first time. Is there anything particular, like what's the thing that they should be eating before they start either intermittent fasting or a long day fast so that it makes it easier? And what's the food that they should be eating when they break their fast?
Well, preparation for fasting is really one of the most important things. We want at least 2 full days of fruit, salad, steamed vegetables only, no coffee, alcohol, or animal foods. So we want people to prep, if they do it before they get to the center, we can get to there quicker. If they're doing it, you know, after they arrive, then we'll feed them for a couple of days on a healthy wean down diet. It makes the fasting a lot easier and the recovery after fasting a lot easier. After fasting, it takes half the length of the fast to recover. We start with fresh fruit and vegetable juices. Then we use fresh whole fruit, vegetables, and then steamed and starchy vegetable materials. We're not using meat, fish, fowl, eggs, dairy products, oil, salt, or sugar. So no refined carbohydrates, no processed crap. And that takes about half the length of the fast. So a 20-day fast, it takes about 10 days of progressive refeeding before you're back on a whole plant food SOS-free diet. And then we ask people to maintain those long-term healthy diets so that we get good long-term outcome and they can, you know, maintain health. Because obviously fasting, even if it's successful, you still have to do the diet, sleep, and exercise to maintain the results.
Yeah, because the biggest complaint that I get is the hunger cramps that people get when they wake up in the morning or as they try to break the fast. And one thing that I've heard...
What do they get?
Hunger cramps.
Yeah, there's... I'm not sure where that's coming from. There's really not much problem with hunger during fasting. And when this protocol is followed after fasting, generally people are satiated and fine. That's not a big common issue. And I mean, this is, you know, 25,000 fasting patients. So I think the reason people are getting those problems is either they're too active or they're eating the wrong stuff as they come off of it. You know, they're getting into some refined carbohydrates or doing something that's causing their system to be out of whack.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why, you know, for example, like my mom trying to fast, I recommend her to eat like avocados before the fast or kind of during the day so that she can actually produce the ketones needed. So she doesn't feel that hunger pain that she gets often in the morning. So do you think fat is a pretty essential component when it comes to?
Well, actually, we're not using concentrated fats before or after. We're using fruit, salad, and steamed vegetables only. So it's mostly vegetable-based material. So high mineral content, low, relatively low sugar content. And then after the fast, we're coming off on fruit and vegetable juices, and then we're coming off on salad and steamed vegetables. But I think after fasting, blood sugar levels are often very stable. So that's, you know, less of a problem. Before fasting, you know, a lot of it's caffeine withdrawal that's the biggest problem. The single biggest problem people have in terms of being miserable early in the fast is they're withdrawing from caffeine and other recreational drugs. If you've gotten them off of those nasty substances before they start fasting, fasting goes a lot easier. For a lot of people, though, that are doing short-term fasting, that's the big problem they're experiencing. It's not even the physiology of fasting. It's just their drug addiction.
Yeah, very helpful. What should people know about, you know, if they want to take that first step into fasting, what's kind of one actionable step that they can take today?
Stop eating 3 to 4 hours before you go to bed every night. And go to bed on time. Get enough sleep. Get some exercise in the morning before you start eating. Limit your feeding window to 8 hours and don't shove anything in your mouth except a whole plant food and you'll be in good shape.
All right.
I tell people, if you want to know whether you should eat it or not, just close your eyes and ask yourself, do I really, 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 really want whatever it is? And if the answer is truly yes, you know, you can't have it because you get nothing that stimulates the dopamine cascade in your brain. You got to get free of the addictions, get yourself stabilized, and then see what it feels like to actually be healthy.
There it is. I can't believe you're not on caffeine or have never taken coffee based on the energy levels that you still have, you know, at 65. So Dr. Alan Goldhammer, thanks so much for being on the show. Really appreciate
it's my pleasure.
Time.
Thanks for getting the word out.
And hopefully have you back next time. Thanks, guys, for listening, and we'll see you guys next week.